Good evening, everyone. My name is Tom. I'm alcoholic.
Hey, Tom!
What is AA? Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. Welcome to the sponsorship group of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is an open meeting of AA, and as such, we welcome everyone. However, we limit participation to alcoholics. In accordance with our seventh tradition, we have no dues or fees, but we are self-supporting through our own contributions. If you are not alcoholic, please do not put money in the basket. Is there anyone new coming back or visiting this meeting for the first time who would care to introduce themselves? Yes, please.
Hi, I'm Kat, I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Kat. Welcome.
Thanks. Not new and or coming back, but I just moved home from Massachusetts, which is where I got sober.
Well, welcome. Yeah. Excellent. Is there anyone else that would care to introduce themselves? Yes, please.
Matt,
an alcoholic.
Hey, Matt.
Welcome.
Right, go Steelers. Anyone else would care to introduce themselves? Okay. The goal of this meeting is to carry the message of hope to the still suffering alcoholic. It is our experience that carrying AA's message is essential in recovering from the disease of alcoholism. As such, we encourage our members to visit with hospitals, jails, rehabs, and other institutions. If you would like to participate in our group activities, join our group, or need a sponsor, see any home group member after the meeting. Will active home group members please identify yourselves?
Oh!
That's scary. Please be mindful that we are guests at this institution, and it's our group's desire to leave every meeting place in better condition than it was when we arrived. If you have a cell phone or pager, please shut it off, and we ask that you limit your movement and discussions during the meeting so as not to disrupt the speaker. And now, for the original manuscript of how it works, we have Eric.
I'm Eric, I'm an alcoholic. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our directions. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or can who will not completely give themselves to the simple program. Usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a way of life which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take certain, then you're ready to follow directions. At some of these, we may balk. You may think you can find an easier, softer way. We doubt if you can. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. Remember that we are dealing with alcohol, cunning, baffling, powerful. Without help, it is too much for you. But there is one who has all power. That one is God. You must find him now. Half a measure will avail you nothing. You stand at the turning point. Throw yourself under his protection and care with complete abandon. Now we think you're ready to take it. Here are the steps we took which are suggested as your program of recovery. 1. Admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. 2. Came to believe a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. 3. Made a decision to turn our will and our life over to care and direction of God as we understood him. 4. Made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. 5, admit to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. 6, we're entirely willing that God remove all these defects of character. 7, humbly on our knees, ask Him to remove our shortcomings, holding nothing back. 8, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make complete amends to them all. 9, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, accepting to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual experience as a result of this course of action, we tried to carry this message to others, especially alcoholics, and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Many, you may exclaim, what an order, I can't go through with it. Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear 3 pertinent ideas. A, that we are alcoholic and cannot manage your own life. B, that probably no human power can relieve your alcoholism. And C, that God can and will. If you are not convinced on these vital issues, you ought to reread the book to this point or else throw it away.
And now we have AA's traditions. And I would like somebody to read the traditions. Megan. All right, Megan.
That's why you call me like every week.
Ooh.
Nice if they were here, Thomas. Where are they? That's how it works. Thanks. Hi, I'm Megan. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
During its first decade, AA as a fellowship accumulated substantial experience which indicated that certain group attitudes and principles were particularly valuable in ensuring survival of the informal structure of the fellowship. In 1946, in the Fellowship's International Journal, the AA Grapevine, these principles were reduced to writings by the founders and early members of this as the 12 traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous. They were accepted and endorsed by the membership as a whole at the International Convention of AA at Cleveland, Ohio in 1950. Here's a short form. 1, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. 2, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as He may express himself through our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. 3, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. 4, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. 5, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. 6, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, unless problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. 7, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9, AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10, Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
And we have a big book reading, one big book reading. Ian, could you read us this little reading here?
Right in.
Thank you, Ian.
I'm Ian. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Ian.
Where's the big book?
It's just this reading right here. I'm sorry. Right there.
So we got a paper reading from the big book.
That's right out of the paper.
Okay. Helping others is the foundation stone of your recovery. A kindly act at once in a while isn't enough. You have to act the Good Samaritan every day if need be. It may mean the loss of many a night's sleep, great interference with your pleasures, interruptions to your business. It may mean sharing your money and your home, counseling frantic wives and relatives. Innumerable trips to police courts, sanitariums, hospitals, jails, and asylums. Your telephone may jangle at any time of the day or night. Your wife may sometimes say she is neglected. A drunk may smash the furniture in your home or burn a mattress. You may have to fight with him if he is violent. Sometimes you will have to call a doctor and administer sedatives under his direction. Another time you may have to send for the police or an ambulance. Occasionally you will have to meet such conditions. Chapter 7, Working with Others, page 97.
Okay. Is there anyone who has an AA-related announcement? Yes, please.
Michael, alcoholic.
Hi, Michael.
There's a couple of alcathons on Christmas. There's one up in the drop-in center in Denville, and the other one close to here is in Cranford at 40 Alden Street at St. Michael's Church. The one in Cranford runs from noon the day before Christmas all the way through midnight of Christmas. There is a main speaker at 8 o'clock on Christmas, and 7 a.m. in the morning they're having a special breakfast. So if you're don't have family, aren't invited to anything around Christmas, join your family in Cranford or Denville. Thank you.
Thank you for sharing, Mike. Is there anyone else with an AA-related announcement, please? Okay. A home group member will talk for 5 minutes on sponsorship and will introduce the main speaker. And tonight I'd like to introduce George, who's going to talk about sponsorship, and he will introduce Charlie.
Good evening, I'm George and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, wait, George. Wait a second. Okay, are you going to Peter? Okay. We have a little celebration. I'm sorry. Hang on a minute here, George. Take a seat. We have someone celebrating 8 years of sobriety. Donna is going to celebrate 8 years of sobriety. And Abby's going to say a little something, I guess.
I'm Abby. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Abby.
Hey. Sorry, George. He looks sad. I've known Donna for a few months. She just recently asked me to sponsor her. We met Donna out in Pennsylvania, and she's been sober 8 years, and she's ready for a new change, you know, in her life, and she wanted to do something a little different. So she came out and did some AA with us, and it's been awesome getting to know her. She's really willing, you know. She calls every day when she's supposed to, right on the dot. Well, yeah, sometimes 12:15, but so. You know, it's really a pleasure. We're getting to know each other right now. We're going through the steps. You know, she's always reaching out her hand to help the next newcomer. And sometimes we're an example of what to do in AA, and sometimes we're an example of what not to do. And sometimes Donna is both. So, but it's. But you know, it's definitely a pleasure. You know, anytime that I can. Be of service in Alcoholics Anonymous is really awesome. You know, it's just an example that AA does work, you know, and that's it. On behalf of the sponsorship group, Don, I'd like to present you with your 8 years medallion.
Be short and sweet, and thank you so much, everyone. Thank you for being who you are, and thank you for teaching me the correct way of sobriety. And I am forever grateful for the honesty that you've given me. And Abby, you've been an awesome, you're a beautiful, beautiful, wonderful person, and you're just like a gift from God. And I just want to thank everybody. That's all I have.
Okay, we'll try this again. I'm George, and I'm an alcoholic.
George.
And that's got to be the shortest time I've ever heard Donna speak in my life. Well, you know, it's good to be here. It's good to be sober. I'm here to talk a little bit about sponsorship and what that means for me. I'll tell you what it meant for me in the early days. I thought a sponsor was supposed to be a buddy, a friend, somebody I can call in the middle of the night and annoy when I was ready to jump out the window. I had weird concepts of what a sponsor was. I thought he was like my ride to AA meetings, all kinds of screwed up conceptions of what a sponsor was. Then I came along to this group and I learned that what sponsorship is really about, I had to learn how to be accountable to somebody, to another human being. To say uncle, to learn how to like be able to talk to that person and be honest with one person in my life about every aspect of my life. And as a direct result of that sponsorship, I've learned to be accountable to family, to other people in my life. And my sponsor taught me from an early start, this isn't about just helping you, this is about you helping others. So 1% of it's going to be me taking you through the steps, 99% of it needs to be you helping others and carrying these, you know, practicing these principles in all your affairs. Carrying the message of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, if you're living by principles, then every aspect of your life will show that. You'll learn how to be a son. You'll learn how to be a father. You'll learn. And I'm like, well, how am I going to learn by doing these things? And I have, you know. He also told me, take action. The action doesn't care why you take it. Just take it. And I did that. And as a direct result of that, I was able to learn how to live and be a little more spiritual fit than when I was there. There's always room for progress. I'm not there yet. But it's a journey. It's been a journey, you know, and I'm grateful for sponsorship. I'm grateful for the fact that, that I was able to learn how to live by principles. You know, I don't feel the need to lie anymore. You know, I'm a little too honest with my sponsor at times. And, you know, he's quickly points out how crazy I still am. And that's what I need. I need someone to get in the way of my sick thinking. Because it sounds really sane in my head. As in I'm, and then as I tell my sponsor, he's like, starts laughing. I realize how insane I am. You know, and that helps. Before, I just play the tape on and do what I wanted to do. You know, now I follow my sponsor's suggestion. Their suggestions. He doesn't tell me what to do. He just tells me, where's the principle behind that? Is it going to help somebody? It's all about helping others. You know, that's what sponsorship has been for me. It's been about trying to help others. It's been about trying to, by being accountable to him, I've learned to be accountable to others, like I said, and pass this on and teach people to live by principles and not make decisions so much based on self. You know, but without any further ado, let me bring up our speaker of the night, Charlie.
Charlie, I'm an alcoholic.
Charlie!
I am terrified. there are things that I don't do, and one thing I don't do is I don't speak. Last time I spoke was here, and it was a long time ago. I don't know, 5-6 years ago. And before that, it was about 10 years before that. And I don't even show up meetings. But, you know, when Jim told me I was a speaker, it was like the worst thing I could imagine hearing. I was really thrilled when Tom was up here and he said, hold on a second. I said, oh God, the speaker showed up. Oh, thank God. You really disappointed me, Donna. But, you know, one of the first things I had to learn in this program was that I had to be honest, and that was really hard because I've been lying and manipulating my whole life. And it took 2.5 years. I relapsed over and over and over. I guess I relapsed somewhere between 60 and 70 times in the first 2.5 years between 1989 and 1992. And I did get 6 months one time. And But that, it's funny, the time I got 6 months was the time that I went out, had a real bad binge with alcohol and freebase cocaine. And I realized that I was going to die if I didn't stop. And so, you know, it was going to kill me. So I, since I wasn't going to use it anymore, I couldn't do it. I would die. There was no reason to go to meetings. So I didn't go to meetings for 6 months. And then this late, I was things were pretty manageable. I was living in a condemned house, so. And we did have electric, but there's no water or heat. And when we when it rained though, the water went down the walls because the roof was in really bad shape and the breakers would flip. So, you know, I was afraid the place was going to burn down. But, you know, my story started back, I was born in 1946. And from what my mother tells me, I was really screwed up from the very beginning. It might be funny, but I'm serious. She said that it was the worst experience of her life. And, she was talking about, you know, the birthing process. I was born very premature. And I was told that they thought that I wasn't going to make it, that I was going to die. And a doctor back then found out that I could drink goat's milk. It was the only thing I could drink. And so they started giving me that, and, you know, and I lived. And but I remember when I was maybe a year and a half, I can vaguely remember some of the things that happened back then. And I know that, and then my mother told me about what happened a few years later, two or three, 4 years later. And so it's kind of, I don't know how much is what she told me and how much is real memory, but I cried all night and kept them awake. They had a restaurant with several employees, and it was one of those drive-ins where the kids or the people would come and drive in with their car, and the girls would go out on roller skates, and they put this thing on the window, this tray with hamburgers and french fries. And but I cried all night, so it was really hard for them during the day. And the waitresses would come over, and I wanted to sleep all the time during the day, and they would walk me one on each side and try to keep me awake. And let's see, we moved to North Carolina. What had happened is my father had, with my brothers, they were a lot older, they had built that restaurant in this naval town. And there were like 40,000 naval troops there. And right after they built it and they opened it up, the government announced that they were closing, you know, the base. And so my father lost everything, and so he went back to work for the railroad on the cars running from New York to Florida. And he ran the dining cars and supervised all the meals. And so I went with my mother. He took my mother and I up, and we lived in this little cabin up in North Carolina in the mountains. And from the first grade to about the eighth grade, we were always moving from one town to another. And my father ended up building more restaurants and running restaurants. And but every year we moved. And I remember first grade was in Miami, Florida. And then the middle of the year, we moved to North Carolina. And then we moved back. And so anyway, I was just back and forth. By the time I got to this, third grade, I was really screwed up. At the end of third grade, the nuns brought my parents in, and they said that I had to go to third grade again because I didn't learn anything. So I had to go to the third grade again. And the next year, and I became very rebellious, and I didn't like the nuns, and you know, they used to make me hold my hands out. I guess I did things that I deserved it, but they made me hold my hands out, and they would hit my hand with a ruler. And I remember they used to make me stand at the board, you know, and they would see where my nose was, and they'd draw a thing a couple inches higher and say I had to keep my nose in there for 15 minutes, so I had to be up on my toes. And I hated the nuns. And another thing I hated was the food there. And so one day they had the worst food you could imagine, and I stuffed it all in my milk carton and fixed it back up and made it look like I ate it all. And they caught me. They found out, and they made me eat the whole thing. It was all this crap all mixed together with milk. And But the thing that upset me more than anything else back when I was little is they forced me to go to church every morning. And I became, I still to this day, I don't know what God is, and I don't like organized religion. And but they used to make us kneel up at church. We had to kneel, and if we kind of sat our butt back against the seat, you know, the nun would be making noises, and, you know, they were very, I just felt like they were the bitches from hell. I didn't get along. I didn't, anyway, my drinking didn't start. I'm going to bypass most of my insanity and go right to, at one point we moved, I guess I was going into the, I was going to start high school. And, I want to say one positive thing about myself, because it wasn't all negative. I did something I was kind of proud of. It was stupid, but I was proud of it in the eighth grade. So it was a Catholic Catholic grade school. And I was new. I didn't know anybody, as always. And the kids knew each other always. And some of the bigger kids were bullying this little kid. And, you know, I never felt connected to anybody. So I always felt very independent. I wasn't connected to these people. So I told the bully who was always picking on this guy that he had to stop. And they said, yeah, well, what are you going to do about it? And I said, well, nothing, but you have to stop. And I said, well, you want to fight? I said, well, if that's what it takes, I will. Actually, come to think of it, I'm not proud of this at all. I forgot the ending. Oh, well. Well, anyway, so we all, the whole class went, it's all boys, we all went outside. And this is a good example of the way my mind works. So I didn't know anything about how to fight. I didn't know how to hold my hands or anything. So I kind of danced around a little bit. He hit me in the face real hard, and I fell down and pretended that he knocked me out because I didn't want to fight anymore. So anyway, they got real scared that they were going to get in trouble, and he apologized to me, and then he was real nice to me for the rest of the year. And I was happy because he didn't pick on that other guy anymore. But I didn't have any courage. This was stupid, you know. But I'm glad I did it anyway. The next after that year, we moved to Ocala, Florida, and that's a town that's about 50 miles from any other towns. Outside of Ocala is just farms, mostly horse farms, and the kids in Ocala all grew up with each other. I guess they went to pre-K, I don't know if they call it that, kindergarten, whatever. They knew each other their whole life, and here I was moving into town. And I didn't know anybody. And so I remember that year, my parents we had quite a few acres of land, and it was a farm, and it was a farm before we bought it. My father had a restaurant, built a restaurant there. And I don't even remember what I was going to say, but this is significant because my parents started meeting people at church and inviting people over from the Catholic Church to, you know, to have little parties, and they had Christmas parties and New Year's parties, and I started drinking all the alcohol that people left in their glasses. I think a few people might be able to identify with that, but I would drink these leftover drinks and start getting a buzz, and I start feeling high. And the next year, since I had been held back, and since when I started first grade, they said I was born a week too late, so I had to wait a full extra year. So I was almost 2 years older than all the kids there. And so they had to wait 2 years to get their driver's license, and I moved in there, eighth grade. That was the highest grade there, and I got my ninth grade, and I got my driver's license in the middle of the year. So I was the only kid driving to school in my mother's car. So I thought I was, you know, a real big shot. And a kid I met had a contact to get beer, and there was a lake about, I don't know how far away it was, maybe 10 miles away, and where the kids would drive down, and there was this place where they had dances, and it was a long pier and this huge building, but out in the water, and they would have these dances, and it was a long way away from anything, and a lot of drinking went on there. And so I was pretty excited about drinking. And the country road was kind of, you know, it's curvy. It's a country road, a lot of curves and huge pastures and fields. So I was really excited about getting that drink. And I was going about 90 miles an hour. And I was going exactly 90 because it's a Nash Rambler. I don't know if you know it. It's a car with a little six-cylinder engine. And that's as fast as it would go. And there was this curve, and then beside the curve, there was about a 40-foot thing going down, and then a fence, and then a huge pasture with cows in it. And we flipped end over end three times. And the guy who was very popular at school. And so I was getting in on the in crowd, I guess, you know. And when we finally landed, he was up about 50 feet in front of the car. The last revolution, it had thrown him out through the windshield. Maybe it was 30 feet, but he was way up in front laying on the ground. And I was still in the car. And there were no seat belts at that time. So that was not too good. I don't even remember anything after that. Except that I know somehow I got home and he went to the hospital. I wasn't hurt that bad, or I didn't think so until a couple of weeks later. I had to go to I was real bad in school, so I had to go to summer school. And so my forehead swole up a lot, and it turned black, and it was sticking out about maybe a half an inch. And it had blood all underneath it, so that's okay. I had a hat and glasses, but the kids liked it because if I pushed up here, it would go out here. So, it was. I looked pretty bad. I really didn't let hardly anybody see my. You know, I kept hidden. I was embarrassed. And thinking back about the person I was, you know, when I was doing my fourth step, I'm so embarrassed by so many things I did in my life. But one thing I'm embarrassed about that shows how dysfunctional I was, I never even called that kid up, never talked to him ever again. And I saw him in school. I wouldn't even talk to him. I didn't call him and ask him if he was okay. I didn't know how to function with other people. And the next year was my next year was my junior year. And I started going out drinking regularly on the weekends. And they had dances every week. Pretty much every week there were dances, either at high school or somewhere, or maybe the next town over. And I seemed to be drinking all the time. And I didn't seem to be able to function or ask a girl to dance or talk to people unless I was drinking. And, you know, once I had a few drinks in me, I could even dance. Now I can't dance anymore. I tried it once when I was sober, and I'll never do it again. All I remember is a real pretty girl at an AA convention. I knew her. She was very attractive. Good. And, you know, while I was out there dancing with her, my face turned red, and I felt so humiliated and embarrassed. I knew everybody was looking at me, and I swore I would never do it again, and I haven't. That was about 10 years ago. But the only way I could dance again is if I was really drunk, and I'm not planning on doing that. You know, I continued to drink quite a bit on the weekends. I remember one time one of the teachers invited several of the students from, I think it was English class, over to her house for something. I don't know what it was, but it was something having to do with work and homework and the stuff we were reading. And I went there, and you know, I drank before I went there, and after a couple of minutes, she asked me to go outside, and she told me never to come back to her house again if I was drinking. And so I was real pissed off and angry, and I left. And because I don't know, I thought it was perfectly fine for me to be drinking. After you know, at the end of high school. I remember after the senior year of high school, it's funny, it was different than up here. This is in Ocala High School, and now I know that up here kids were smoking pot and taking acid and everything. We never heard of anything. We were so isolated. The only thing we had was alcohol. And after high school, there was an article in the Life magazine by Timothy Leary, or about Timothy Leary, about LSD. And I couldn't wait to get my hands on that stuff. I just wanted to try it out and see what would happen. And there's some things that about me that I'm really embarrassed about, that I talk with men about sometimes. Or I always talk to my sponsors about it, but I feel uncomfortable talking about it in a mixed group. But I know in this group, the thing that's always impressed me about this group is I know you guys go out speaking all the time, and I've never been here when I didn't hear an incredible message. The speakers that come to this meeting are really good, except for that time that I spoke. And, you know, when you speak every 5 years, it's a little difficult. But I wish I hadn't said what I said 2 minutes ago. Yeah, I don't know. I have a couple of things that really bother me that's embarrassing. Maybe I'll I do talk with people about it. I do sponsor a lot of guys, and I have a couple things that I'm still hung up on, that I have trouble talking in front of women about. Well, I'm going to try to do it though. I was pretty wild, and you know, I used, whenever my parents would leave town, they would you know, go away for a week. I don't know why they did this, and they would leave me at home with the keys. They must have been out of their minds. And I would have these huge parties, and wasn't too good. But anyway, there was a girl who kind of wanted me. And, you know, I didn't know what to do with girls, you know. My father, I didn't know anything, but I knew a little bit. but not much. Actually, somebody gave me a deck of cards when I was 17. I had naked girls on it.
Nice.
And I was looking at those. But I did. Nobody told me anything. And I was fascinated. I kept looking at them, and something very embarrassing happened. I thank God I was by myself. And I didn't know what happened. All I knew is I felt great all of a sudden. So this was a problem. So anyway, my parents leave town in my junior year, and they're going somewhere for a week, and they leave, I have, of course, stolen the key and made copies of it so I could drive my dad's car because they flew, and I brought all these people over, and this girl wanted to sleep with me, and I went in, and I couldn't figure out how to do it. I was really humiliated, and it was a real problem, and I was really drunk. That might have had something to do with it. But anyway, my parents took me to when they came back, I finally told my dad, look, you never told me anything. I don't know what to do. And I had this girl, and I didn't tell her it was there in his bed. And I said, I couldn't do it. I couldn't find the place you're supposed to put something in, And my dad was so screwed up, he took me to a urologist instead of telling me himself. My dad could not talk about things. My dad never talked to me about things. He was a workaholic. He was a great guy. He worked 16 hours a day, but he couldn't talk to me about things. But there were some great things for my family. I never heard my parents argue. I don't think my parents ever in my whole life told me a lie. They were very honest. They worked really hard. But they didn't tell me I'd have sex. So I went to the urologist, and the urologist said, well, it might be because you have some curvature. And maybe you should go and have this major surgery. And I said, okay. So they sent me to Miami, and I had this, major surgery on my penis. And it was like, I don't know. So anyway, it was terrifying, though, because I was in there for a day. And they wheeled me into this incredible operating room with all these lights. And they had a thing over, and they pulled the thing off. And I looked, and here were like three or four beautiful women standing there and one guy. And they pulled this thing up, and everybody's looking at my parts. And I'm going, oh, my God. So then they gave me the stuff that, I went unconscious. And I woke up in the recovery room with the other surgery patients, and there was like 15 of them in there. And I was laying, in the recovery room. And, I had a real lot of trouble, emotional trouble about this problem of mine. And as soon as I could wake up enough to see, I looked around, saw these other people, and saw they were staring at me. And I looked down, and under the covers, they had wrapped my penis up about 8 inches higher. And they put a blanket on me. So I'm sure everybody thought that I had like a 10-inch erection, and I'd gotten very aroused having the surgery, and I was really embarrassed. And I got the blankets up, and I tried to put them up there, and then some people were coming in to hold the hands of their loved ones, and they were all staring at it was really embarrassing. So, maybe that's why I became an alcoholic. I don't know. But, I after the 11th grade, I I went up. There was a guy living outside of town, and the town where I lived, everybody was very conservative. I played rock and roll music, and I started a band. But people had long hair, had hair that was like, it was like the Beatles when they just started growing their hair long, and the adults in town thought that was absolutely terrible. And there's this old guy living out in the woods with about 30 people who followed him, and they got me to go out there with them and meet him. And he traveled around the country lecturing on tantric and Tibetan yoga. And so I started following him around and listening to him. He taught the Bhagavad Gita, the Tibetan Book of the Dead. He lectured, you know, at universities. And I went away with him, and he had a place in Vermont, 500 acres, really secluded. And there were lots and lots of people would come up there, and we were all hippies, you know, real long hair and beards and very radical. And we drank a lot of wine, we took acid, we smoked pot, and talked about the fact that capitalism was going to crumble pretty soon and we were going to take over and all kinds of crazy stuff. But in any case, I had been married. I left my wife to go up there. I was married, and I sold my drums and got enough money to get the plane ticket because I knew there were a lot of hot young girls up there, and I didn't want to be married. I told the girl, I don't know if I was married. I told her I didn't want to be married, but if it would make her happy, we could go get that thing from the Justice of the Peace so my parents would quit giving her a hard time because they were Catholic. But I told her, this doesn't mean that I believe in marriage. I don't believe in it, and she knew that. And that was one of the most difficult times of my life. I felt so guilty because she wanted to be with me forever, she said, and have children, and she'd get drunk and fall down the stairs. She told me she was going to kill herself if I didn't stay with her and if I didn't quit looking at other girls. And I just couldn't take it. I sold my drums, got on the airplane, and went up to the mountains of Vermont. And eventually I decided that I've got to settle down, and I came to New Jersey. Someone offered me a job here, and I was a workaholic. I worked sometimes 100 hours a week. I started my own business, and I would work, 12 hours a day, but I would get drunk at night. But I would work all day. I wouldn't drink during the day, hardly ever drank during the day. And a few years ago, I guess about 22 years ago or so, I started going over. I was alone. I had been working 100 hours a week. My life was empty. I didn't go to church. I didn't have any friends. All I thought about was, you know, I became somewhat of an engineer, and I started doing drafting, and I was designing door systems and a new way to install doors. And that's all I cared about. And every cent I made, I would put into my inventions. And so I wouldn't rent an apartment. I wouldn't buy a car. Everything went into my work. And I was just totally empty and miserable because all I cared about was work and becoming very wealthy. I wanted to have a lot of money. And I was so miserable that on Friday nights, I'd go over to New York and walk around that area with all the girls and everything. And prostitution was disgusting to me. I didn't want to do that. I wanted love. And, there were a couple, I met a couple of young girls over there, and they were too young to be prostitutes. And they said, let's smoke some cocaine. I didn't know what that was, so I tried that out. And I tried that. I tried it a few times, and it didn't do anything. It didn't work for me. And but I wanted them to fall in love with me, and I wanted to be the knight in shining armor. And and then one night I finally caught on. I said, "No, I'm not giving you money. Go buy this stuff. I'm going with you, or we don't get it." So I went and I bought it myself. I said, "No, I'm holding it." I said, "No, I'm putting it in the pipe, and I'm going to take the first tip because I'm not sure I'm really getting any." And so I took a big hit off of this pipe, and this is about the third, fourth time I'd smoked it. I'd never felt anything, and I was in heaven. I was in heaven. I remember the thought I had. I immediately thought, oh, my God, when I die, when I'm going to die, when they tell me I'm going to die, I know what I'm going to be doing. That was the thought that I had. And it went on and on. I kept drinking, but I kept going back and smoking that stuff. And I did it once a month. I did that for a few months, and then I did it twice a month. And then I started doing it every week. You know, I'd work all during the week, but then I'd go over there. And then my friend, wasn't as fucked up as I am, said, look, you got to stop doing that. You know, you're going to screw yourself up. I'll take you over to Brooklyn where I get my heroin. Oh, no, what am I saying? The South Bronx, I meant. South Bronx. So he took me over there, and he got his heroin dealer, because he never bought it himself. He had someone go buy it. He didn't want to take the chance. So this guy went and bought me these huge vials of crack for a nickel. I couldn't believe it, you know. And so I was off to the races then. I started going back and forth there all the time, and I couldn't stop. And it got really bad. And over a period of 2 years, I went on maybe three, four-day binges where I went over with, you know, I'd go over $1,000, and I couldn't stop until it was all gone. And it was really, really scary. I was in, you know, I would go over there. I had a whole routine in my van, and I would have my old dirty, raggedy clothes and ripped up stuff, and I would, you know, take and tape a $20 bill here and a $20 bill here and one in my leg, because if they mugged me, you know, I didn't want them to get all my money. I wanted to have it hidden in a lot of places. And they finally caught on, this little gang of guys who were like 16, 17 years old. About 10 of them mugged me, and they forced me to tell them where my money was hidden. And I just borrowed a bunch of money. They got $900 from me, so I was going to quit after that. But anyway, it was a nightmare. And the only thing I regret right now standing up here is, you know, I always mean to talk mostly about recovery, and I've talked about nothing but qualifications. I want to talk a little bit about what's happened to me in the program. I found out that I really believed after a couple of years that unless I was totally and completely honest, that I wasn't going to be able to get sober. It was going to be impossible. And so what I did was I started going to 3-4 meetings a day after about 2.5 years of relapsing. And in between meetings, I would get to a meeting early, and I would stay at the door, and I'd greet everybody, and I'd get something to read because I could barely talk in front of two people, and I would read. And then when the meeting would start, I'd put my hand up, and I would tell them the total truth. It was really humiliating, really embarrassing. I said, I don't think I should be here. You know, crack brought me down. This is Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, people kept telling me over and over again, do you want to not drink anymore? And I'd say, yeah, I can't drink. If I drink, I'm going to go back and do the cocaine. They said, well, that's the only requirement. You're welcome to be here as long as you have a desire to stop drinking. So finally, after about a year, I quit questioning that. But during that year, and I'm talking about the third to fourth year, during that time, you know, I was going to 3 meetings Monday through Thursday, and I was going to 4 or 5 on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. All I would do is be in every meeting I could go to. And I figured out how to do it. I was living in that condemned house I told you about, and it was raining inside. When it rained inside too. It was rough. I had a lot of buckets around, you know, to catch the water, and I would stay out all day, you know, going to meetings. And I was having a hard time getting to these meetings. Sometimes I would walk 10 miles. I'd ride my bike. I took two buses to get to my home group. And then finally I realized that I could go out to, I forget what it is. There's a little town out here that has a huge junkyard. I went in there, and I, except going in through the gate, I climbed down through the fence thing. And I had a propane torch and a razor knife, and I heated up a windshield, and I scraped the inspection sticker off without damaging it too much. And I put it on my old car that wasn't registered. And I drove that car to a couple thousand meetings. And then after, I had a year sober, and a policeman pulled me over, and he said, "What's that funny thing around your inspection sticker?" He said, "I pulled you over because there's something funny about that little..." And he said, "Is that tape?" And I said, yeah. So I told him the truth. So he put the handcuffs on me. And, so I went to jail for a few days. But, you know, at this point, I guess I've sponsored about 60 to 70 guys, and maybe 10 of them have stayed sober. And right now, I'm sponsoring about 8 guys, and they call me all the time. I'm not alone. I'm connected. I wouldn't be here tonight if it wasn't for Arthur calling me up. Thank you, Arthur. And God, my life is wonderful compared to the way it used to be. I go to a meeting every day. I go early. I stay late. I have commitments. I'm the chairperson at the 12:15 meeting in Summit, which we meet there 6 days a week. I'm the what's called the overall chair. So it's a perfect job for me because I don't have to share. I can share and make announcements and things, but I don't like talking in front of people. And so I don't really have to say anything. I just get there early and make sure the coffee maker's there. If he's not, I make the coffee. I get the speakers on Sunday, except when I can get someone else to do it. And I've got a guy I'm working with right now who stayed sober, a physician. He stayed sober 6 years, called me every day. He drank 6 years ago, and then he got a year, and then he drank, and now... for the past year, he keeps coming to meetings and he can't stop. He can't stop. I don't know what to do, but I'm just gonna just keep doing what I'm doing because it's, I can't get him sober. I talk to his wife regularly. And, you know, my life is really, really good today because I feel like, there's a lot of people who call me every day who I feel very connected because I've been talking to them for years every day. And, they haven't figured out how fucked up I am, I guess. You know, we talk. You know, I figured out the secret. They call me and we talk about them. And I, but, one guy calls me every day and he's got 6 years now. And he's called me every day for 6 years. And but to be honest, you know, I do whenever they're going through something, I tell them the truth about things that I've been through and how screwed up I was. And I feel like I'm helping some people now. Tonight, to be honest with you, Arthur called me up earlier about 6:30, and I was very depressed. And I get that way sometimes lately. 2.5 years ago, they told me I had cancer and it looked real bad. And I had 4 surgeries and the last one was 11 hours. And after the surgery, I felt really, really bad. And then I found out that I couldn't have sex anymore. And I'm having a hard time adjusting to that because my dream was, you know, I wanted to get married and have children now. And so I've been having a real hard time adjusting to the fact that maybe I'm not going to have romance in my life. And it's been 2 years since the last surgery. So, but things are, you know, as a result of me doing the right things and people helping me, I had people take me over to the Summit Housing Authority. 2.5 years ago, I was almost, I was getting ready to start my business that I'd been working on for 28 years. And I had a 7,000 square foot corporate center. I had $6,000 a month rent. Things were going great. I had a bunch of consultants working for me. And I got rushed to the hospital, and I got the news that things were really bad, and I had to shut everything down and throw out three-quarters of my stuff, take this is my prototypes from my inventions, and throw them in storage, and then go in the hospital. And when I came out, I started going to three meetings a day, but I had no energy, and I was homeless because I owe out $550,000 from that business startup. So I was homeless 2 years ago for a half a year. People took me over to the Summit Housing Authority, and I filled out the applications and all. And now I have a beautiful apartment. The government pays for everything. And I don't have to work. All I do is I go to a lot of meetings. I talk to a lot of people in recovery on the phone. And, you know, I have a really good life right now. I'm very grateful that I'm not alone. And I'm really glad that at this point, I'm glad that Jim asked me to speak, although I didn't feel that way a little while ago. But that's my story. Thanks.